President Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ecology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this August the 27th on the West Coast, now August the 28th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to welcome those also listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, and hope you enjoy tonight's show. We have our usual Friday night guest, although he is quite unusual as an individual. So he is our weekly Friday night guest. Leave it at that. Before we bring him on, I want to share something that is kind of a really neat explanation that people in the business world should understand what the dilemma in the state of Arizona has been. Now, for those of you who still watch mainstream media, you've heard a certain spin, if at all, about what the intent is in Arizona to curb illegal aliens from entering that state. And there has been a very lax permissive policy for a number of years, even though they told us they were going to build a wall to prevent people from coming in to the country illegally. Of course, that didn't take place. That was another lie that we were told. And the officials in Arizona, particularly the Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, has made a career out of arresting people that have no business being in this country illegally. Now, we don't write the laws. The politicians do. They like to call themselves legislators. Even when their laws make no sense, even though their laws infringe on the rights of people who have every right to be here, such as permitting other people to break the law. I mean, we have these double standards. So this little piece is entitled Arizona, and it's described as a great way to break it down so thick-headed people can understand. Arizona Governor Jan Brewer on sports and immigration. Comment here, wow, does she know how to shut someone up or what? The owner of the Phoenix Suns basketball team, Robert Sarver, opposes Arizona's new immigration laws. Arizona's governor, Jan Brewer, released the following statement in response to Sarver's criticism of the new law. And this is a quote from the governor. What if the owners of the Suns discovered that hordes of people were sneaking into games without paying? What if they had a good idea who the gatecrashers are, but the ushers and security personnel were not allowed to ask these folks to produce their ticket stubs? Thus, non-paying attendees couldn't be ejected. Furthermore, what if Suns ownership was expected to provide those who sneaked in with complimentary eats and drink? And what if on those days when a gatecrasher became ill or injured, the Suns had to provide free medical care and shelter? Pretty much sums it up, and that's the comment of Arizona Governor Jan Brewer. It makes a lot of sense. If we apply this to any state in this country, just on the basis of the three major professional sports, and you can throw hockey in there if you need to, imagine that these owners of these sports franchises, which are all controlled by leagues, and that word league is an important word, it really tells you who's operating this from behind the scenes. If they all had this dilemma, they would all go bankrupt. Likewise, if we all decided not to attend their ritualistic events, then quite possibly that could cause them to go bankrupt. Well, when you think about the fact that money itself as a debt instrument is an illusion, it's not real wealth, it's not true wealth, what is this all about? It's nothing but an illusion and a diversion, really. But you can cause those that think in terms of profit and loss, to see the threat to their profit, which causes it to become a loss, and they get pretty steadfast and start coming up with all kinds of reasons why they have to step up security and prevent people from sneaking into these events. Well, it doesn't really occur on a large scale, but I can tell you from personal experience that people do try to sneak into all kinds of events for nothing. They feel the world owes them something, and they owe the world nothing. Now, I don't condone either attitude, to tell you the truth, but there are so many out there that do. And until we wake up as a society and see things the way they really are, we'll never begin to understand what our problems are, let alone solve them. Think about that during tonight's show. Right now, I'm going to invite to the microphone our regular but highly irregular Friday night co-host, who is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and our resident science advisor as well, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. It's always good to be with you. How are you tonight?
I'm in very good spirits tonight. I got to clarify a situation or some terminology with some people this evening. And, in fact, it was along the lines of what I was talking about here. I was asked the question, when are the aliens going to reveal themselves to the world? And I knew what they meant, but I said, let's get something straight. We refer to them as the visitors. Is that who you're talking about? Well, yes, the visitors. I said, well, the visitors are in the process of revealing themselves, and that will happen more and more. But in the meantime, the ones that we call the aliens are the ones illegally crossing the borders, sneaking into the country time and time again, even after being deported. Those are the aliens. So we had a good laugh, and then we had a very interesting discussion. But I left this event feeling that a lot of people were waking up. I didn't initiate any of the conversation. Everyone else did, and I was asked many, many questions, and I sort of reveled in the fact that I was witnessing people that I know are very skeptical by nature, which one should be, but are also educated in the old system, not in the insanity we have in our educational institutions today, and communicated their feelings from the heart as to the nature of the universe and the nature of the true nature of mankind and even God. And the first question they asked me was, what are the visitors' standpoint in regard to God? And I assured them that God is very real to them, and that they do have a faith, and that they pray, and they are very advanced. If they're as advanced as I know they are, or one could surmise, not just technologically, but spiritually as well, how could they not know the true nature of God? And so it was a very rewarding time spent together, exchanging ideas and information. So let's continue that on tonight's show, if we may. Now, you and I have been talking about energy, power, these concepts, and for the past couple of weeks, we've been talking about electricity. And on more than one occasion on the show, especially on Friday nights when you're my co-host, Jim, you and I have talked about consciousness. We've been talking about consciousness for the past 8 months nonstop. week by week. And it's come out of my mouth and out of your mouth, and we have been in agreement that there is such a thing as life force. There is a fundamental power or force, energy, however you want to describe it, that permeates everything in the universe. And it follows certain laws, which we could, for simplicity's sake, call universal law. And you had mentioned to me off the air about a book that you had come your way, and the relevant topic that book is about falls into the same category of what you and I have been talking about. It sounds like something I would like to read, and I'm sure many of our listeners. Would you care to share some of that information with us?
You mean concerning the life force itself?
Well, in regard to this book, first of all, and then, you know, that opens the door for us to basically talk from our own experience.
Well, regarding the book, I only heard about it yesterday. I haven't secured a copy for myself, but apparently it's written by someone with some pretty interesting credentials. Matter of fact, I think I have it right here. Yeah. The name of the book is The Life Force, A Scientific Basis. And it's written by a guy by the name of Claude Swanson. Now, I haven't had a chance to look the guy up yet, but according to the friend of mine who gave me the information, he's pretty savvy in the way of things, and he's been studying all kinds of physics and quantum mechanics and things of that sort. I don't know if he's a professional, you know, physicist or something. I don't know anything about him. But I certainly know about that kind of subject. It's always been fascinating to me, and I'm going to invest in it. This book when I get a chance, because I want to find out exactly what is meant by a scientific basis. I mean, it implies, for instance, that there's ways of actually making measurements or confirming the existence of this force. Of course, we're all alive and we're all endowed with a certain quantity of it, which may be proof to us on a subjective level, but as you know, scientific matters require a more objective way of looking at things, and so I'm very fascinated to see just what this guy's written about.
Mm-hmm. Now, if this is Claude V. Swanson that you're talking about, he's a physicist who studied at MIT and Princeton University. Is that the same one?
You know more about him than I do. I don't know, but if it's probably the right guy, because the, you know, that kind of a background certainly sounds like the sort of foundation you'd need to write about this subject matter with integrity and accuracy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. He's also got a background that is going to raise a few eyebrows, but that's not intended to be a negative comment. It's just going to raise some eyebrows. I myself would be interested in looking at that. It touches upon something that we have talked about on a number of shows, as I've already mentioned. And I think we referenced the Star Wars movie. You know, there was this mystical term used, the term the Force. And, of course, what the Force was never explained to anyone. They put that out there for us, not to have us understand it, but to basically say, here it is right in front of your nose. See if you can figure it out. Bet you can't. You know, it's that attitude. Because if you really intended for people to understand what those things mean or are intended to mean, then you would put the truth out about them, wouldn't you? And it opens up a myriad.
Providing you had the truth. I mean, I really don't know exactly how much information is out there about this subject other than what certain specific people have written about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think when you know, you can Google Ms. Swanson's information. He's been on some few radio shows. Maybe we'll have him on this show. You never know. Maybe we'll invite him to the show with you here.
That'd be nice. That'd
if
be
he's inclined. What I see, and I know that he has investigated the paranormal, so we're talking about something that's beyond the understanding of most scientists, certainly beyond the understanding of the textbooks, yet something that's been written about in many of the secret documents or the secret, what's the term I want to use? Doctrine and agendas of secret societies. They like to talk about these things in symbolistic ways, but they don't always reveal the secrets. They just like to talk about them as if they know everything about them. Now, truth is available to anyone that connects with it. It's a very simple process. It happens by looking for it, or it happens by you being open to it and receiving it and then understanding it or seeking to understand it. You know, it's a process of recognizing the truth. You can often recognize it from a distance, or sometimes it has to hit you over the head like a sledgehammer to get itself across to you. But generally, the truth is non-invasive. It's there. It's always there, and it always is what it is, and it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be preordained to follow a particular pattern, and that seems to be one of the biggest pitfalls of the life experience right now is that whenever anyone gets close to the truth, and they announce that truth and they spread the truth to others, it seems to be resented by those that like to operate in secret. They don't like the truth to come out. And it doesn't matter what the truth is about. If it puts them, if it casts light on their activities and their fraudulent nature or their evil nature, it gets their dander up. They get pretty upset about that. Well, that's understandable, but we have just as much right to feel the same way about what they do. In fact, we may have more right because the creation is a positive process. It's a never-ending process. And the creation was not designed to be destructive. So when we talk about things like the Force, or we maybe get more specific and surmise that they may have been talking about the life force, which is what makes us alive, what brings us about, what creates us. We're talking about something which is huge and shouldn't be hidden from anyone. It's the whole key to being happy and living a meaningful, fulfilling life, regardless of what you're doing. It is, as long as it's not destructive, as long as it's not killing people, as long as it's not stealing from people or causing people to become sick or causing them to go back into a stage of a primitive existence, and as long as it doesn't cause them to be ignorant or cause them to lose their souls, it should be permitted. So life, what is life force? It's that which sustains, that which has the capacity to exist. It goes beyond just living. We're talking about existence. an existence with all the attributes intended for that entity to experience and to contain as it was created. Now, I'll stop there and allow you to comment, because I'm sure you've got a million things you want to say in that regard.
Well, the first thing I want to say is something I've given quite a bit of thought to, quite frankly. You know, our planet is such a remarkable place, and it's literally teeming with life. I mean, life is really everywhere. Of course, there's been so many extinctions, some of which were even caused by man, that, the count is down from what it used to be. But nonetheless, there are so many life forms on this planet that it's enough to make your head spin. And even if we disregard all of the various species and concentrate only on mankind, there are so many human beings here now, you know, that's another manifestation of almost seemingly endless amount of life. And what's interesting is there's so much life that the miracle of it is somehow lost in the head count. And what I mean by that is that if you go to a lot of countries where there's a lot of belligerent activity going on, and I don't want to name them, but I'm sure you're as capable as I am of figuring out areas where that type of thing is going on. The amazing thing is that life is cheap. You know, it's looked upon as being, you know, nothing to hold in reverence. And I think that's only because there's so much of it. And that in itself is a very strange phenomenon when you stop and think of it. Because here is a great miracle of how basically, you know, fundamental elements that are found in the earth that we walk on are not only rearranged, but they're animated and given intelligence by a process that we can't understand. And we don't seem to be overly interested or overly involved in investigating what that's all about. On the contrary, we seem to be much more involved in engineering better ways of snuffing life out.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the best weapons. We've got all manner of drugs and abusive substances and bad food and water that's been tainted and chemicals in the air and God only knows what else, all of which seems to accelerate the decline of life. But for some reason, the most remarkable phenomenon that we're aware of is just not held in the proper regard. And it's a very strange thing to me.
Yeah, if I may say so, what you're alluding to is that there is an order in the creation. There's a specific divine order that just operates like a fine-tuned machine. And as soon as we start manipulating it contrary to the universal principles that hold it together, it produces chaos, which induces destruction. And ultimately, you know, the ultimate form of destruction, which is death. And there, this aspect of the life force, this life force has to go somewhere, doesn't it? It gets transmuted from the living being in which it is contained. And life force can be in a rock, too. Just because the rock appears to be dead doesn't mean it's not alive. Just because we can't see the molecules moving and recognize that the rock knows it's a rock and doesn't try to be a politician, you know. No pun intended.
There's some exceptions.
Yeah, with some exceptions. Maybe a box of rocks it brings about other possibilities, but we'll leave the box out of it for the moment. There seems to be a pattern of capturing that life force. In fact, even from the living entities, while they're living and experiencing life, they come up with ways to do that by preoccupying the entity, the living entity, with the obligation to distribute their private wealth to a bunch of crooks who've devised a number of schemes to demean those people or those entities and tap into their life force, see, or parasitize themselves. Parasitize the entities and leech off of the entities like a vampire would. So this struggle between life and death is going on while we speak. And the more truth we put on it, the more we tip the balance toward the side of the light, toward the side of the truth, and in honoring the life force. And that process itself may, at least causes the entity to be aware that they are existing because within them is a life force and it has a value. And the value goes way beyond debt instruments or Federal Reserve notes. It goes way beyond that. And that's what we should be looking towards. So just wanted to make that comment because as you were speaking, I'm seeing what you're describing down here is the chaos that causes that life force to become scattered and released into other realms through a whole myriad of devices that are designed to do just that. Ultimately, when a person dies, their life force has to go somewhere. And that is what is sought after by these beings that are bent on destroying anything they possibly can. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, the interesting thing about what you just said brings me back to a book which I have mentioned at least a dozen times on this show, Scientific Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain by Lynn Schroeder.
Yes.
That's an amazing book. I've got a copy of it back in New Jersey somewhere. And the reason that your comments have linked me to that book was because there was one section in there on the study of life. And they mentioned the fact that in Russia at that time, which of course is back in the 60s and 70s, there was a considerable amount of work being done, you know, to actually make some fundamental and scientific measurements concerning this process we call life. And what they reported on in that book was the fact that people that were dying from various reasons were interviewed and asked permission if they could be monitored in a variety of ways as the end approached. And so they had a bunch of people that said, well, sure, what's the difference? You know, it's not going to hurt me any. So apparently they amassed a large amount of information about the processes that are associated with death. And not only did they chart all of the changes in metabolism and body chemistry and blood gases and the obvious things of that sort that would have to undergo a change during that experience, but interestingly enough, they came up with the idea of weighing the person on an extremely delicate scale and also taking photographs through various types of filters as the moment of death occurred, and even running movies, movie film, to capture the entire process through various filters. And all of this pointed to the fact, just exactly what you said, something leaves the body, and it's quite measurable. They noticed the change in weight.
Mm-hmm.
When a person dies, they had those figures in there. They also had mentioned the fact that something can be seen leaving the body when the moment of death is viewed through these various filters and whatnot. And so I've been interested in this phenomenon, you know, since I was a kid, but I was very much enforced by reading the experiments that the Russians were doing back then. And I always thought it was a fascinating thing that a country that was supposed to be very atheistic and filled with so-called non-believers was the only country at the time that was doing substantial and fundamental work in a spiritual capacity. You know, it's very easy to talk about all this stuff and just assume that there's a spirit or a soul or whatever that carries the life. But here was a situation where people were actually investigating this stuff. Now, the other thing that leads to, about 10 years downstream from that time point is, my connection with Wilhelm Reich's work. And I noticed when I read his stuff that his very descriptions of his own experiments and his own investigations into this life force, which, of course, is also associated, I might add, with all of the disruptive aspects of living. For instance, if the life force is manifesting in a very positive way, you have a very healthy person. And obviously, if the energy flow is not quite in accord with the universal scheme of things, illnesses appear. So all of this whole idea of the life force embraces more than just being alive. It also describes a state of health. It also describes your vitality. And I might add also that it is very much linked to all of these esoteric phenomena that people puzzle about, you know, like telepathy and telekinesis and seeing the future, and all these different things are somehow tied in with this force. Now, according to Reich's work, he identified this as actually being a physical and measurable aspect of nature that manifests itself primarily in the atmosphere once it arrives on this planet. But over the course of some 30-some-odd years of research, he also concluded that this is the same substance that when it's free of the planetary mass and operating in open space, that it is responsible for the phenomenon that the ancients referred to as the vortex.
It mm-hmm.
is the force that turns the planet, creates the atmosphere, and then manifests as a component of the atmosphere, so that life can form, and of course, it then animates whatever creatures evolve in that particular biosphere. I think one of the most interesting phenomena associated with this occurred back in the 50s sometime, when Wilhelm Reich designed an experiment to demonstrate negentropy. And he took one of his orgone accumulators, which for those folks who don't know what it is, it was a special box that he designed which seemed to attract the life force and then concentrate it in the volume defined by the measurements of this box.
Mm-hmm.
And he built a special version of this accumulator and stuck a thermometer in it. And what he noticed was the fact that after a few minutes, the thermometer temperature began to rise, and it would rise to a level higher than the temperature of the surrounding air, which, of course, was monitored with another thermometer. So there's obviously something going on there, even though it appeared to be a totally static situation. And he brought this experiment to Princeton, and in an interview with Albert Einstein, he demonstrated this in private, and they discussed the meaning of this phenomenon. Now, there isn't too much that I know that was published about it, except for two things, which I find really amazing. Einstein's first reaction was one of elation, because he was excited over the fact that here was a demonstration of the opposite side of the coin, so to speak, which gave some insight into the higher symmetries in nature. We're very familiar with the catalytic side of nature, where something comes from a higher potential to a lower one. And all of our technology and much of our philosophical reasoning is associated with that type of activity. There is no general information about the opposite side of things, where something can build up without any apparent assistance from a lower potential to a higher potential. And that was the reason why Einstein found it a fascinating thing, because in those days, he was struggling to develop his so-called unified field theory, and he was wondering if this wasn't part of the picture that he was missing. But interestingly enough, within 2 or 3 days after having had this private chat with Wilhelm Reich, he then went ahead and denounced the entire phenomenon. Now, it really makes you wonder, you know, what was responsible for that 180-degree turnaround. Was it a question of the fact that he meditated on the situation and felt that perhaps what he had witnessed wasn't representative of what they talked about? Or was there more to it politically?
Yeah, you know, I think possibly, you know, there were two possibilities in answer to that. Well, you didn't really ask a question, but you proposed at least a question, in a sense, semantically. I think maybe he felt that what Reich had discovered and communicated to him and demonstrated to him unequivocally challenged his own methodologies and his own published statements, and couldn't come to grips with the fact that maybe he would have been knocked down a peg or two on the scientific totem pole, if you will, or he was told to do that, he was instructed to do that, or both. Maybe there's three possibilities. Is that what you're alluding to?
I would go along with that, because gut-wise, it feels right.
Yes.
You know.
What's
interesting about the whole thing, we know that a great deal of Einstein's work was actually usurped from the writings of an earlier time. This guy Boscovic, who was an alchemist, wrote about relativity and the interchangeability of mass and energy many years before Einstein ever considered it. And the interesting thing was that he took some of that basic information and rearranged it to suit his own needs and published it as his own. And this is one of the reasons why Tesla despised the man, because it turns out that Boscovich was a Serb, and, you know, and Tesla admired him deeply. And, you know, he just looked upon that whole thing as being plagiarism for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
So I don't think that Einstein has the absolute shining reputation that he's been blessed with by the scientific community. And we already know that there's a great deal to be yet to be found in applying his concepts to the real realm of nature, because it doesn't answer all of the questions that that people hoped it would.
Jim, not to change the subject, you mentioned something a little bit earlier when you were making your comments about the research that the Soviets were doing. I think at that time they were called Soviets, right? So I put that in the political context. You mentioned that, you know, these people were atheists, or we were told they were atheists. Well, all a person needed to do any time was to look at the number of churches that there are, were and are all over Russia, all over the former Soviet Union. What purpose would the churches, and this is a rhetorical question, you don't have to answer it, what purpose would a church serve an atheist? So that's part of the propaganda lie. And then you referred to the Iron Curtain, and I had this image of the Wizard of Oz. When Toto is pulling the curtain, the veil, which exposes the wizard doing all his magic, pulling levers and speaking into a microphone and using all kinds of special effects for dramatization of his fear-mongered message. And something as simple as Toto pulling on that curtain revealed the truth. Now, they referred to the Iron Curtain as if it was some impenetrable curtain, comparing it to the Wizard of Oz. I recall Reagan's words in Berlin when he said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall." Okay, you remember that statement. Why didn't he say, "Tear down that Iron Curtain"? You know, it raises that question in my mind. That they don't really identify the myth or the illusion, they create another one, or they reference another illusion. And now, to a lot of people that lived in East Germany and around Berlin, they experienced that wall, and they saw many people being shot trying to escape over it or through it or under it over the years, and most of those attempts were foiled. Of course, we won't hear about the successful ones because they would never admit to people having escaped. But we always heard rumors of that, or we saw it in movies. That's part of the illusion of that whole process. It's only a reality in terms of how much we're willing to give away our power to reinforce that illusion. And I just wanted to make that comment. Now, in regard to the vortex phenomenon, and I had a feeling early today that we were going to be talking about vortexes. That thought just had entered my mind. I didn't know why, but I want to address that because, to me, if there is a vortex happening and man has no idea what causes it and what creates it, it's most likely a result of a universal law at work. We're witnessing the creation being what it is without our interference. Now, paying attention to it or harnessing that force, that energy, even though it's unseen, it's measurable in a variety of ways. It manifests itself in different phenomena, And at the same time, as it's doing what it does, it keeps being what it is. It's how we interpret or how we perceive or how we interact with that causes it to become something else, to be part of an application, or to be understood as to its true nature and why it exists and how it can be tapped into, how it can be used, how it can benefit mankind. Well, there always seems to be somebody trying to stop that from happening, that process, stopping us from getting at the truth of understanding reality the way it really is, not how it's presented to us, not how it's wearing a mask and makeup and photoshopped to be something other than what it is. Anything to stop the truth from getting out. That's that insatiable quest to steal the life force of all living things because it's contrary to what's natural. And I think so much of what Einstein was involved in was not natural. It was destructive. It was already the opposite of what Reich was doing. So it didn't take him very long to come to the realization of the true nature of his work. I don't know how you feel about that or if I made myself clear in making that statement, but to me, that's my perception of why he would react negatively.
Well, I think it's a shame that he did that, irregardless of what his motives were, because I really believe that the missing link that he was looking for in this so-called unified field theory probably involves the very thing that he rejected. According to Reich's work, the way the universe is set up is that you actually have, and we've talked about this too in other shows, you actually have these streams of cosmic orgone energy that are moving through the cosmos at various angles. And when they come close to each other, these streams, especially when they're approaching a right angle, they break off and attempt to wrap around each other. And in doing so, they form these galactic spiral-type arms, which we see. And these can occur on the level of a galactic disturbance. They can be on the level of a solar disturbance, and they can be on the level of a planetary disturbance, just depending on the magnitude of these flows that are involved. Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing is when this occurs on the level of a planet, these streams intertwine and coalesce as they shrink, and they drive all manner of space dust and particles that are flying around in cosmos and debris of all sorts towards their center. And eventually this causes an agglutination of mass or material to build up. And as it begins to build up and the temperature goes up, it can become the core of a planet. It can become, you know, the basis for a sun or a star. And actually, I find that instinctively to be correct. Because the most beautiful thing about that way of looking at it is that it's the same activity that's happening all the time. And the only thing that changes the result of what you get is the scaling factor. You know, so if we're talking about something like this happening on the galactic scheme, you know, then you wind up with a spiral nebula. Mm-hmm. If it's happening on a solar level, you wind up with a star.
Yeah.
If it's happening on a planetary level, you wind up with a planet. So once the planet is formed and this material is accumulating in the atmosphere, this life force is accumulating in the atmosphere, you know, any kind of living beings which evolve in that region are also going to have their own little vortices of life, so to speak. And there have been so many reports by sensitives and people who have studied the occult that human beings in particular have their own little vortex of these forces flying around them. And they're not only responsible for sustaining life, but they also carry the basic essence or signature of the being that that they're supporting, so that when life departs, you know, all those attributes go with the force that is released. And one of the things that I have seen, and I've seen this myself, I can tell you quite literally that this is true. The interesting thing is that people, you've all heard the expression dead weight. People are actually heavier when they die than they were when they were alive. And that's a very noticeable phenomenon. I remember when I was living in northern Michigan, there was this great big Norwegian fellow that worked in the mine with me. We were pretty good friends. And he was about 6'4" or 6'6". I don't remember exactly. But you know how guys get, you know, roughing around and whatnot. And there were times when we got pretty frisky. I was able to lift him off the ground. And he was able to lift me off the ground very easily because he was a monster of a guy. But unfortunately, about the third or fourth year that I knew him, he died of a heart attack. And it was on a Sunday morning, and I was eating breakfast when the word came into the restaurant, and I left there and went up to his house. And I helped carry that guy out. And I can tell you that it took all of four men to lift that man's body on the stretcher and carry him out. And it was actually feeling heavy when we did it. And that's a far cry from being able to put your arms around somebody and lift them off the ground. So there are so many aspects of this that seem to suggest that it ties into gravity, it ties into electrostatic energy, because people have an electric field of their own. It ties in with the orgone field that Reich talked about. And it's a completely neglected science. So I'm very excited about getting a copy of this book and find out just what has been going on behind the scenes, which this guy has apparently coalesced into a singular writing.
Mm-hmm. It, you know, I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. In fact, you're saying the things that I would say, I think, if I was describing it from my perspective, and I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying. When we talked about energy and we talked about information from source, we're talking about in its purest form, which has all of the every possible intent in it, and that energy, for whatever reason, is propelled outward to other realms and multidimensionally. I'm convinced that that happens not on one plane. It's not a straight line. It's happening in ways that we can't even conceive. And yet, I know that the possibility exists and that it really does occur. In other words, what becomes a planet, what becomes a life form living on that planet, what gives life to that entity or those entities that are living on that planet, and to the and what sustains the planet and keeps it together and keeps it functioning is nothing but intelligence, just manifest into the physical form. So what is, you know, rhetorically I ask, what is so difficult about understanding that is the key to understanding what the solutions to the world's problems are. It's in seeing who we really are, seeing life as it really is. These are frequencies, we know that. Light frequencies, sound frequencies, and maybe some frequencies that we've not yet been familiar with. We've not heard the terminology, or we haven't perceived them. And I can tell you, those that intuit what's going on in the universe are tuned into more than just the light and the audio frequencies. That's a given. On what plane does that occur? Is that in a space that's void of time because it doesn't require time? It's just a pure state of existence? And why is it that as things manifest into physical form, why do they become corrupt? Why do they have a tendency to become corrupt? Or why are there beings that corrupt what is pure? That's another question, because I think that identifies who's behind all of this. So, you know, I'm trying to sort of tie all this in together in terms of the life force, or any kind of force for that matter. Its origin has everything to do with the fact that it all came from a pure state of total consciousness. And as it moves through time and space and these different dimensions, it's exposed to the energies of experience and the energies of corruption or evil, whatever you want to call it. Anything that has tried to be what the creation is or what the creator is. Anyone that has tried to mimic that or tried to replace that as if they could. So, you know, it really points us to where we need to be looking for our answers if you look at it from that perspective. Your comments?
Well, that is the perspective that I looked at it from when I first got involved with it. To be quite honest with you, when I read Reich's work, and believe me, when I got introduced to his stuff, I went out and bought every book that I could find in the English language that addressed his thinking and his research, and I read them more than once. And the conclusion that I came to was that Reich's work is a tangible path directly to the nature of the divine. And that's probably why it was so suppressed and he was persecuted. It's because the powers that be do not want you going in that direction. And that's exactly what it is. I mean, we are all said, since we're kids, we're told that anything in that realm of spirit is totally intangible. Well, supposing it isn't totally intangible, supposing there are manifestations or links, or call them what you will, that tie the physical to the spiritual. If we started to investigate along those lines and start to understand the forces that are at play and the design which is inherent in all this, which implies, as you pointed out, intelligence. The interesting thing is that for the first time, you would have a real study of the divine, a real science, if you will, that could be called theology. Because I don't care what religion you read, they don't really ever get to the point where you know something about the nature of God.
That's
but
because
really
they don't know.
What you really wind up knowing about.
Yeah.
What you wind up knowing about is the interpretations of other human beings who are contemplating the nature of God. And that doesn't tell you anything about God himself. It tells you more about whoever did the writing. But
yeah.
I think that the the fingerprints or the signature, if you will, of the divine being is actually on the fabric of reality already. And it's right in front of us, just like everything else is. And it's up to us to make ourselves conscious of it, to pursue it, and study it, and open up a channel, a more direct channel, right to the nature of God. If we could do that, it would change this planet drastically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what Reich was on to. I really do.
I agree. You know, consider that if one looks at prayer and the power of prayer and questions, you know, what is actually occurring when I'm praying? Am I supplicating to some unseen, unknown, omniscient, omnipotent power that I'm fearful of recognizing, because that being, that creator is going to see me for who I really am, and I can't come to the point or the realization that someone sees me as I really am. I mean, that's what religion teaches us to fear. We're told to fear God, but we're not told why fearing God is the best option. We're not, in actuality, it's a lie. It's an illusion to fear God, because the nature of God, in that God created us, is certainly the opposite of, you know, that dogma that we have to fear the Creator. If fear is intended to mean respect or admire or love, then I'm just using a few different words that apply equally. Why does fear even have to be part of the equation? Or honor God, or commune with God, talk to God. And I think prayer is a supplication, but it opens that pathway to this unseen energy, this life force. We invite life force into our reality when we pray, or when we intend, or when we know. And I strongly feel that these belief systems are really ways to blur or mask these clear pathways that are there. They exist. Reich proved that energy exists. Tesla proved it. Maxwell proved it. Many other scientists, Boscovic, you mentioned, they were all aware of this. And many others, many philosophers, many artists, many musicians, composers, many of the classical composers came here to change the vibration with sound. That was a way to do it in those days. They didn't have the same technologies that they do today, but they misuse the technologies today to hold us in lower frequencies. Those, you know, Mozart came here to raise the vibratory level of this planet, and therefore raise the consciousness and open the hearts. And when you listen to his music today, it's beautiful. Animals love the music. Plants love the music. And they respond positively to hearing it in a multitude of ways. So in terms of what we're experiencing here, it seems every avenue of opening up to that pathway has been disrupted with obstacles and blockades and all kinds of different means of cutting us off from what is natural in the whole universe. This is not the only place. There is evil in our solar system, let alone in our galaxy or any of the other galaxies that exist. But there's a similarity. We see these spirals in other galaxies. We see the vortices that we're talking about, which shows that this phenomena goes on all throughout the universe. And we may not understand the purpose Why do we need more than one galaxy, or why do we need more than one solar system? It's not a question of needing them. They were created. And instead of honoring the creation, we have to destroy it. Or we have to submit, we have to give up our life force, our power, our internal power, our God-given power, to feed this. Because in and of itself, who they are is void of any of this life force. They exist. They're driven by certain energies, but it's not in tune with the creation. It's not the same vibration. It's the opposite. It's inverted. In music, you can really destroy a melody, but present it in a different way using what they call retrograde inversion, playing the notes backwards and upside down in terms of their intervals from each other. It works musically, but is it necessarily the vibration that we want, you see? And we don't understand how important that is in being able to connect with that. So we're talking about consciousness, but we're also talking about the way life operates in the most natural of circumstances. Your comments, Jim.
Well, one comment that definitely popped into my head when you were describing that, particularly the music. You mentioned Mozart, and of course there's so many others.
And many others,
Haydn,
yes.
Haydn and Beethoven and all those guys. The music that they created was astoundingly beautiful and so varied in quality and texture. And the question that comes to mind is, where are those guys today? Where is the modern equivalent of it? You don't see anybody, or at least I certainly don't. Maybe you do because you're in different, you run in different circles, but I don't see the equivalent in the 21st century of anybody like Mozart. And if you take that to another level of expression, where are the Leonardo da Vinci's? Where are the Michelangelo's? They're not around. And so it's like, if you just look at the Renaissance and what flowed from that as a yardstick, you might say, that alone points to the fact that humanity has been degraded significantly just in the last 500 or 600 years. Because if you look at paintings, for instance, you went through, you know, the classics, and then you went through the masters, and then you finally got to an abbreviated situation where you had the impressionistic movement, and then you got into modern art. Well, it's all very well and good that you can look at this stuff and say each of it represents an art, but I have a different perspective on it, because when I look at it, I keep seeing shortcuts. I keep seeing situations where there's less effort, less understanding, less beauty in each of the various formats that we define as art, until finally you get down to the scribbling that people pay $500,000 for and stick it on their wall, and you don't know what the heck it is. That is an absolute far cry from what somebody like Leonardo, for instance, or Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel. It's so different and so opposite that it makes you wonder what has happened. And I think that, you know, it gets back to the same thing we've been talking about. It's a slow, well-planned disconnect from the creative forces, from our higher selves, and this artificially contrived spiral that drives people towards lower frequencies instead of the higher ones. Now, you know, I'm sure that there are people out there that are going to criticize my comments on this because, you know, they may be very fond of the cubic movement or impressionistic movement or whatever. But the point is that there's no two ways about it. If you take something that was painted by let's say, Leonardo or Michelangelo, and you compare it to something that sits in the Guggenheim today with a modern stamp of approval on it, the difference is like night and day. And I see that that decline in everything. I see it in technology. I see it in writing. I see it in music. I see it in art. I even see it in architecture. I think that the buildings that they design and put up today are totally soulless. You know, they're just a minimum expression of functionality to get the job done. And it makes a statement about what we have come to be in this modern culture. No soul is what it boils down to.
Yeah, you're describing a process that's been introduced into every aspect of life. Certainly it's there in art, and it's there in music too. And it's the synthesis or the I'm going to have to make up a word, but the technological manipulation of reality into a synthetic environment. That's what's occurring with music. The robotizing of voices by putting them through a ring modulator, which is it's a novel kind of sound, but do we have to hear every singer from a country singer to a rap or hip-hop artist or an R&B singer or maybe even an opera singer singing through one of these devices, which makes them basically sound like a robot? It's designed to dehumanize the human experience. It's, again, designed to disconnect us from what is natural. Now, I'm not saying, and I don't think you're implying this either, that the masters, the impressionists, were the absolute best the universe could produce in terms of art. Where do you define where excellence begins or where it ends or what the limits of it are? I think it's a matter of touching one's heart and raising the vibration so that the person who's viewing that art or listening to the art form, if it's music, for example, or the reciting of poetry, for example, in a live performance where the poet is actually reading the words with the feeling and the modulation and the inflection that's intended, and putting out the emotion. You know, they're putting out the energy when they emote. They're sharing it. They're communicating it. We're designed to interact with the universe, not be cut off and severed from it. So what you're describing, Jim, I'm just going off on a tangent in a way, but describing that process as I see it, and I think a lot of people would agree with me. All you have to do is turn on the radio and listen to how they're manipulating sounds. They're not natural anymore, and that makes us become attuned by frequency to what is not natural. And the two don't exist in the same place. You know, they have these basic scientific rules. Two objects cannot occupy the same space at the same time. In terms of dimensions, that's true. But multidimensionally, what process is occurring when two objects are one object is superimposed over another one? Say an unnatural object superimposed over a natural object occupying the space now multidimensionally. What impact does that have on the life force that's experiencing that phenomenon? I think that's an issue that we should be looking at. Not just in a scientific sense, in a metaphysical sense, in a spiritual sense, in a conscious sense, a mindful sense even, but not one born out of bias and or confusion or chaos or destruction. have to recognize it and learn to understand it, what it is in its purest, truest nature. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does, and it ties back to another aspect of Reich's work also. You mentioned the word robotics, and
yes.
What's interesting there is that, you know, if you look at a human being that has no armoring, you see an absolutely spontaneous and fluid movement. If you look at a person who is very neurotic and has a great deal of body armoring, which is these forces blocked within the musculature of the body, they act in a very mechanistic way. Their body moves like it's articulated. There's no flow. There's no continuity of motion. Everything is like choppy and stiff. And that's the body's way of saying, you know, that I'm all locked up. I got these energies bound up in me. And it's so dramatically opposite to what you see when you see the movements of somebody who's perfectly fluid and perfectly in accord with the nature of these forces. And what's interesting is that when you have a person who is armored, and I mean severely armored, they will always resent meeting someone or being exposed to someone who is not armored. Did you ever notice that, like, a little puppy, for instance, can bring such joy to watch it bouncing around and filled with all this energy and fluidity of movement? The same thing with young children. And yet, those same stimuli that a healthy person regards as a form of beauty will actually instill very negative emotions, even to the point of anger and resentment, in a person who is armored. Because subconsciously, he resents the fact that he's not that way. And our whole society seems to be moving toward an increase in this mechanistic expression, even to the point where, as you pointed out, it's literally moving into and having an effect upon the arts, especially music.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this has been going on for a long time. And you know, it's done through these mindless TV shows that are turned into contests. I think of American Idol. I think of all the wonderful singers that I know are out there that wouldn't subject themselves to this chaotic parody, you know, this pretentious contest that they're going to find someone that we should worship. And then, you know, they call it American Idol. This is someone to idolize, to worship. And, in you know, the Ten Commandments given to us by God the Creator instruct us not to worship idols. But we don't seem to see that, you see. We don't see that as a people, and we don't see that as individuals. We don't recognize the manipulation that's going on and how unnatural that is. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't appreciate one's talent. But don't give us garbage and tell us that it's prime rib. You know, don't give us cream of wheat and tell us it's caviar. And I'm not saying one is better than the other. It's just, it is what it is. But there's this illusion that it's something much greater than it is. And that's you know, that causes a lot of resent in the people who are truly in the art form for the right reason. Whether they're a singer or a musician, I mean, they demean the art. intentionally. This is done by intention. Because if you were concerned about putting out the best of the art form, the best that the world has to offer, you wouldn't subject people to what they subject you to. If you've ever seen that show, I mean, it can be ridiculous. It's supposed to be about singing. I mean, you have people putting on Halloween costumes, dressing up like Santa Claus, and acting totally dysfunctionally in terms of what is regularly acceptable to society on a sunny day. They make it look chaotic and improbable. They make the person that's participating in this act look insane, and I think half the time it's done intentionally. They find people that are capable of going outside the box and just being as weird can be. And that's acceptable because that drives down the vibration of consciousness. It causes illness in people. It causes all kinds of intangible problems. Certainly doesn't raise the consciousness of anyone. So in the long run, it has to be destructive. Yeah, somebody gets a record contract, they get a lot of fame, they get a lot of people worshiping them until they fall out of favor for one reason or another. Athletes, professional athletes are another group, you see. And what does all of this have to do with why we're here? We're here just to be entertained and to be driven like slaves? Or do we have a higher purpose? And is our recognition of that the doorway to solving our problems? I say it is. We're almost out of time, Jim, but I want to allow you to comment, if you care to, on what I just said.
Well, I'm 100% agreement with you, particularly on with your last statement. I think that it's erroneous to believe that the divine entity which created the universe and us didn't give us the necessary pathway to actually find our way back towards him. And I think that the problem is that these individuals who run the planet have gone out of their way to minimize the importance of these pathways and to suppress any knowledge associated with it. But there was definitely a time in the past when this was much more readily understood. And I think some of the greatest civilizations that ever lived were aware of these things and made use of them. And that's the reason why they had such a spectacular long existence with such a rich understanding of the esoteric. Now, it may have degenerated over time so that we no longer understand exactly what they were doing. But if we start to look at things with a fresh eye and always be cognizant of a goal to find our way into a science, a new science, that will allow us to understand more about the divine and our place in the universe, that would certainly be a milestone for humanity. And I would love to see that type of thing happen.
Yeah, well said. I agree. I think, you know, what tonight's show's about, and we could really get deeper, much deeper into this issue of life force, and ways to identify how it manifests itself and how it travels through the universe, how it incorporates itself with life. And maybe we can get into that a bit deeper for those that would like to hear more of a technical explanation rather than spiritual or philosophical. Ultimately, spirit is what it's about, though. So I don't think we'll ever throw that out the window in our conversations, but I think understanding what is really occurring. You see, when you have a society of producers and non-producers, the non-producers basically are vampires who are just sucking the life force out of the producers. And as soon as we recognize that, and the implications of what that really means in terms of eternity or infinity, then I think we'll begin to recognize the true source of all the world's problems, certainly humanity's problems. You can pick out any problem, I think, on the earth, and at some point, mankind is the root cause. And let's give credit to some of those non-humans that play a role in this, whether they're in the physical or the ethereal demonic realms. Jim, it's been a very interesting show. Do you want to make a closing comment?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that comes to mind as a closing comment. I would like to buy a copy of this book and read it, and then use the material that's disclosed in that book as the nucleus for other conversations, because I think that this is an area where humanity needs to start to focus much more deeply. And this gentleman apparently has something to say if he can fill a book that has over 700 pages.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to checking that out, too. Would you repeat the title of that book one more time for the listeners?
Yeah, it's called, just a minute, I got it right here. It's called The Life Force, A Scientific Basis by Claude Swanson.
Okay, Claude V. Swanson, I think, is his full name, so... If, in case you're interested, ladies and gentlemen. Jim, it's been fascinating. There's a higher vibration going on. Do you feel that tonight?
Yeah, actually, I'm pretty sensitive to that type of stuff. I just go with the flow, and it usually winds up determining what we talk about, to be honest with you.
Well, I look forward to your next appearance on Evident Footprints. That will be next month. Can you believe another month has flown by?
Yeah, unfortunately I can. Life has a tendency to just accelerate away.
but I think we're in for some pretty interesting times. You'll be back with us on September 3rd, so... I look forward to your next appearance on Evident Footprints. Wish you a good night and a fantastic weekend.
Well, thank you, Don. I'll be talking to you soon.
Okay, folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com and tonight's special guest, Jim Murray. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting this show around the world. Also, I want to thank Seth Hendrick on the sound at bbsradio.com, Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday, the 30th of August, when my special guest will be Dr. H. Ruat. In the meantime, have a great weekend, and I wish you a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.